You are listening to The Nature of Things on WRVO. This essay originally aired on January 4th, 1991.
We take it as a matter of faith that the longer we study a thing, the more we'll know about it. But at times we have to admit that observation not properly controlled can reinforce unfounded superstitions or conventional wisdom. Consider the fact, for instance, that for centuries it was believed that those songbirds, which disappeared each fall when the weather was still mild, and reappeared each spring as it turned mild again, had actually spent the winter hibernating in hollow trees. For those tiny warblers which nested in Europe and were later discovered in tropical Africa in winter, the theory was that these tiny birds hitchhiked on larger birds such as geese, storks, and birds of prey. Swallows, it was believed, actually hibernated in the muddy shallows of wetlands, like turtles and frogs do. You see, the conventional wisdom was that songbirds were too small and too weak to migrate as the waterfowl did. Observations of swallows caught in fish nets, dead birds in the tree cavities, small and large birds found dead next to each other, and other things which would today seem as anomalies were in ancient days taken to confirm the conventional wisdom. How could such mistakes occur? It was very difficult to discern individual behavior patterns when there is no individual identity, and except for the occasional recognizable deviation in plumage or recognizable injuries, the birds had no individuality. Most bird historians credit John James Audubon with initiating the idea of marking birds so that they are recognizable. He tied silver threads to the legs of a brood of phoebes, observing that two of the five returned the following spring, still bearing the thread on their legs. It's a bit incredible, isn't it, with all the interest in birds through the ages, that Audubon, early in 1800s, should have been the first to mark a bird to establish its identity. That's how spotty the record is, until 1899, when a Dane named Mortensen began the systematic marking of storks, teal, and starlings. The results he obtained stimulated others to undertake similar operations. Knowledge and understanding of birds escalated rapidly with the assignment of individuality to the birds. In 1911, the American Bird Banding Association, sponsored by the Linnaean Society of New York, was supplying bands and attempting to coordinate banding activities. By 1920, the potential of banding and supplying information was established, and the U.S. Biological Survey in Washington took it over. During the next decade, nearly 500,000 birds were banded, and nearly 20,000 returned. The information provided about migration routes and dates was pivotal. It marked the first real statistics on bird movement. Still, a 5% return on investment seems modest. Part of that low rate is explained by the fact that most early banding was of nestling birds, for which mortality rates are greater. Also, chances of recapture were quite low until more modern methods of trapping and netting were adopted. I have no record of the numbers banded since 1930, but with modern data processing techniques, a bewildering array of information and analysis can be obtained. I could get that with ease, I think. At one time, anyone who wanted to volunteer might obtain a bird banding permit. Today, it requires more validation and serious purpose to get a banding permit, along with meticulous record keeping. Still, those who band birds know that there are pleasures which extend beyond research and record keeping. Birds are indeed exquisite creatures, wonderfully made. To hold a male warbler, a male tanager, or an indigo bunting in your hand to observe its perfection up close is indeed a rare pleasure. That's all I have for today. This is John Weeks saying thanks for listening. Tune in next week and keep it natural.